Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of Only Murders in My Mind. And we've got our usual gang with us. I'm going to introduce Mike first this morning.
Hi, Carol. Hi, Liz.
Hello, Liz. You're right. Yeah. And we're going to talk about historical crime. And we're very lucky to have Paula Harmon with us, who is a writer. She's spoken to us before. We invited her to come and have a discussion about this. And we're really, really pleased. Welcome back, Paula.
Hi. Thank you for having me back again.
Because we've got two people in the room, I know Paula's virtually in the room, who have written quite a lot of historical crime. Both Liz and Paula, you've gone back into the Roman era, haven't you, when you've done some books, yeah. Some of it in Victorian times. I just wanted to ask Mike if his novella could be historical crime.
That's a cracking idea, Carol.
There's so much potential.
I think the thing is that I'd already decided that it would be more sort of futuristic.
Maybe
when I write the second novella.
Couldn't it be historical and futuristic? Sort of like a kind of Victorian, like H.G. Wells, so Victorian science fiction.
Yeah, well, he did have a time machine.
Steampunk.
Yeah.
He did have a time machine.
Paula, I get bullied by these two ladies about this novella of mine. Now I'm being bullied by three ladies.
I think it'll be tragical, comical, historical, past.
I think it'll be tragical.
Why do people like historical crime? Because it is very popular, both as, to read, and then they make films out of it and television series and podcasts and all this sort of thing, audiobooks. So what is it?
It's funny I can think back to one of the previous times when we were talking with Paula, and she was talking about how history was intriguing and that she wished she'd done more studying of it at school. And I remember, as being a teacher, I used to love teaching history, because to me, history gives you that great outlet to tell stories. Mm. And I think all teachers should be storytellers. And I consider myself as a storyteller. And when you look back into any period of history, you can find events that you think, wow, there's a great story behind that. I often think about the Great Fire of London.
Oh, yes.
And I'd love to tell a story. In fact, I started writing a story. It might even be I started writing a short story from the point of view of an apprentice who used to sleep under the butcher's shelf in the shop at night. And he was one of the first ones to come out and discover the fire. So he was telling the story from his point of view, from sort of a 10-year-old's point of view. And I think that's what history allows you to do. Yeah. It allows you to be wrapped up in actual historical events, but it also allows you to be creative and to give other points of view.
I did wonder if you're going to say you're going to write it from the point of view of the fire, which I thought would be an interesting angle.
Yeah.
I did once write a story about the Great Fire of London. It went backwards.
Backwards?
Nobody liked it. Don't know why. One of those things. Never mind.
Yeah, I like things because of the job I do. I like things about plagues and viruses and bacteria.
Maybe explain what you do to the listeners, Carol.
I wouldn't, Carol. Leave it there.
You're typhoid Carol.
No, not typhoid Carol. But that's an interesting story. I train people to give vaccines. And I'm very interested in all the things. Oh, my special interest, if I was on Mastermind, would be the Spanish flu. I can talk endlessly about the Spanish flu.
Oh, you might be handy to me sometime.
Well, anytime you want any help on things like that, Paula, please get in touch.
I'm a bit concerned, Liz, that these two might just take up the whole episode talking about the Spanish flu.
Well, I can join in because one of my characters actually died from the Spanish flu. So.
Anyway, as I was saying about the Great Fire of London,
worry again.
Yeah, so we've also...
But, sorry, the Great Fire of London, of course, was what finished off the plague.
Mm. Yes.
And it never really came back in the same way, did it?
In one of my books, Raphael's Uncle's Bookshop.
And do you know, why didn't I know that?
I'm surprised.
I must have read it somewhere, but I can't. It's not in the front part of my brain, but, you know, I am getting old.
Well, it's maybe not something you need for every day, is it?
No, no, that's true.
As you can see, Paula, we tend not to keep any sort of script.
No, you don't. Oh, it's shocking.
I think, one of our Zoom calls.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I think some of the things with history, I think that, like you say, there are events that you can look back on, and because you're not living through it, somebody can sort of encapsulate what was happening as if it's a real story, and real life's not like that. It's much more straggly. But when it's written down, it feels like a neat thing. Obviously, in the past, clothes more interesting. So, you know, obviously nice, all those fancy dresses and, you know, cloaks and hats and goodness knows what. And I think there's a certain fascination and challenge with when you haven't got technology. So you haven't got instant communication. So even if you allow for Victorian and Edwardian times, you've got post four times a day or whatever, and telegrams and potentially a telephone, it's still not instant like it is now. You haven't got the forensics, you haven't got the DNA, you haven't got, you've got them, but you know, you can't utilise them. That creates a different challenge, and it's just interesting because then you have to concentrate on working it out without as much science. And the further back you go, the less and less science. And I think
I was going to say, I remember someone asking me about, I said, I'm going to write a mystery. And they said, what, set in the present day? And I went, yeah. And they went, what, with mobiles and everything? I went, yeah. I went, that's going to be difficult. Yeah. I thought, possibly it is, but I'm going to give it a go.
It's CCTV is a nightmare. You have to think, wouldn't anybody pick that up on CCTV? You think, it's a small town, they haven't got any. It's just saves time. And I think also the other things you can also, I suppose, to be brutally honest, dabble in some of the nastiness of previous eras that don't happen now. The whole social attitudes, the attitudes towards women, things like that. It's a chance to look at that. You got to be very careful not to make it anachronistic, I think. And when you read books where it is, and everybody's very nice to women and treat them as equals, and you think they really didn't do that, then it's that just grates on you a little bit. But it's just I think it's a chance of seeing how people have changed and how they're the same.
Yes. Have you ever gone down a research rabbit hole?
Oh, all the time.
Leading question.
Yeah, no, it's shocking. I gave a talk, and I was talking about, it was supposed to be about clothes and about whether clothes stopped women from doing stuff. And I found out things about the dojo that was set up by somebody to teach women how to do a form of jiu-jitsu as self-defense, what they were wearing there. A woman who developed a form of jiu-jitsu using parasols. The first international beauty contest in 1913, which was won by a girl from Dorset. You know, loads of things. And one of my favorites is about hatpins. And this literally boils down to this. A Miss Schmidt, or Fraulein, it should have been. But anyway, she got off a tram in Vienna, I think, and her hatpin caught a man in the eye as she was doing so. Injured him very badly, and ultimately he lost his sight. She then proposed marriage to him, and he accepted. That is all that's in the paper. And it's like, why? What? You know, it's just fascinating.
Well, he was probably worried about what might happen if he said no. I mean,
well, possibly.
I was going to say, women did carry around some deadly weapons, didn't they? Because hat pins were enormous, and they'd have, is it chatelaines?
Yeah.
Thank you, with all the scissors and everything on around the waist. They're very pretty then, but I bet they were heavy.
Yeah.
They did have, and like you say, an umbrella. You give somebody a thwack with an umbrella.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. One of my characters does that whenever she can. That and a handbag. So, yeah.
Did it have a brick in it? That's what I wanted to know.
Well, I've got a character who has a very special sewing kit.
Oh, what for? Sewing things back up again?
It's not really for doing any sewing at all.
It's funny, though, you talking about research like that, because I sometimes think that while the research in historical novels is important, you have to be careful that you don't bombard the reader with too much research. Mm. One of my favourite historical crime books is by Sampson, Disillusion.
Oh yeah,
it's the first, the two or three books, and I think it's Matthew Shardlake is a lawyer who is the main protagonist who solves the crime.
Well, those set, by the way. So I've always meant to read
Henry VIII.
Ah,
yeah, Tudor times. Mm-hmm. Thomas Cromwell is the baddie who sort of influences Shardlake, mm-hmm. and there are some tremendous descriptive parts within there when he talks about the smells of London or wherever they are. But you don't need to be an expert on Tudor times to enjoy the book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you overdid the research, it could take you away from the murder mystery, which is basically what it is.
Yeah. Didn't they just kill people then? You know, they just killed people, didn't they, and walked away?
Well, up to a point. I think they did have quite a lot of very detailed rules and laws, and they had different courts. So that if you were dressed, because you weren't only allowed to wear certain things if you were a certain class of person. So if you were poor, you couldn't wear purple, and you know, really stupid things like that. So you could be up against the magistrate, and if you were living immorally, you'd be up before the church court. And there were loads of things going on. It's really quite fascinating, and I think you would get arrested for certain things, but it was just being able to prove what had happened.
What about witchcraft then? Because it was nearly all women, wasn't it, that got...
Well, there were a lot of men as well. Witches. Yeah.
There's a lot of political intrigue then too, you know. And I think the other thing, if you go back to say, Tudor times, it depended on which strata of society you came from. So if you were a poor person that got murdered, probably nobody took much notice. Mm-hmm. But if you were somebody in the king's court or...
I imagine if you inconvenienced the lord of the manor somehow, you would know all about it.
Yeah.
And if you were a poor person who murdered another, you know, relatively poor person, then there wasn't any justice as such. They just assumed you were guilty.
It might be rough justice from your contemporaries, potentially, I guess.
It always amuses me. It makes me think. It's not funny. When I watch things about the end of the First World War...
it hardly ever talks about the Irish flu. I mean, millions of people died. Millions!
But do you think that's a bit like COVID? That in a way we stopped talking about it at some point, and we've sort of like... almost university prefer to think it almost happened in a different universe, and we've just put it to one side. We just want to forget it, and it's only 4 years ago, and we sort of carry on as if it never happened, and yet so many people died.
Yeah, I remember talking to an author at some kind of fair, I think it was, and saying, "Oh, I went to a talk by you a while back," and he said, "Oh, when was that? You know, was it recent?" I said, no, I think it was in the before times, and I caught myself doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think of it like that, in the before times.
Yeah.
But I think it's only sort of maybe in the last year or so that I've referred to it in a book.
Right.
So I think in Murder for Beginners, I say about, you know, so I think you said, Paula, that Fee had, you know, she'd managed through the pandemic, and I think Jade had done some supermarket delivery work.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's as close as I've got.
I think Lucy Worsley, when she was talking about Agatha, I know this is Agatha Christie's books aren't historical, but when she was writing, or not just her, but Dorothy L. Sayers and all of them who were writing in the 1920s, and all of the characters and those authors had been through hell. They'd gone through the First World War. They'd lost relations through fighting. They'd lost relations through Spanish flu. And they talked about the war, but they didn't talk about the Spanish flu. And there's all this kind of almost... emotionlessness about the book. Somebody's dead, and it's like, oh, this is a challenge, not I'm heartbroken. And it was almost like collectively everybody was suffering PTSD and just so shocked that there was just, they were over on overload on horror, and so they'd turned life into something that was a puzzle, and on all the really horrible stuff they'd sort of like shelve. I think Dorothy L. Sayers, to be fair, did deal to a certain extent with the shell shock much more than, say, Agatha Christie did, you know, in a couple of her characters actually talking about how it infected them, but affected them even more than it infected them. But yeah, I think there was a collective decision almost not to talk about it.
I did not find that's true. I mean, of many worldwide historical events, you know, so people talk about before the First World War, after the Second World War, before the Second World War, after the Second World War. And COVID has almost got into that same category. Mm-hmm. You know, if before COVID, after COVID, it's almost as though you want to miss out or almost forget COVID, about the middle bit. You know, the horror of the war, the horror of COVID. It's as though you want to draw away from that. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Is that the way we... I mean, going back to what you were saying about the people accepting are not being terribly upset on the surface about deaths. It was a time as well when women, married women, and probably married women as well, had large families, but not many of them survived. Mm. You know, you could have 9, 10, 11 children and only have 2 or 3 because of all the childhood illnesses, because, I mean, poverty had a big part of it. So did they accept death more readily? I don't know how to phrase it, really.
I think that by the 20s, that was probably more true of the poorer classes than the richer classes, because richer classes could get contraception. It wasn't, you know, it was illegal in some countries, it wasn't illegal in Britain, so you could get hold of it. And there was more of an understanding that if you only had 4 or 6 children, they were going to survive more likely than if you had 10. But I think people still grieved if they lost a child. I imagine if you were so poor. I don't know. I just think you've read Luckrise to Candlefoot, haven't you, Liz, I think?
And yes, I have.
There's a bit where somebody talks about somebody in the village, this is the 1880s, trying to explain to other women how to restrict your family. And the other women's, you know, they're poor as anything. And they say, well, why would you resent another mouth to feed? You know, it's still a beloved child. So I think they did grieve, but perhaps accepted is in a way. I don't know. I think.
Yeah, I suppose they had to get on with life, didn't they, Paula? They had other children to worry about and try to feed. But
so what's your favourite period of historical crime, Carol? I put you on the spot there.
Well, I do like the Tudor era. But as I say, when I've watched it, it's been usually people dying in like the court, you know, like people being, like you said, the king didn't like them, so they die of poison and mysteriously disappear and that all that sort of thing. So they seem to get away with a lot of crimes, where, as Paula's just pointed out, which I wasn't thinking about, there was a court for everything under the sun by the sounds of it. Mm-hmm. If you were a poor, hard-working person at the other end, mm-hmm. you know. But, I mean, historically, is it historical, the 1920s?
That
is the era that I really like to read, watch, listen to. Mm-hmm. You know, again, Hercule Poirot, Sherlock Holmes, all those sorts of things. When we were turning a lot of corners, I think, both scientifically and hopefully morally, we were starting to look at the world slightly differently.
Mm-hmm. I love the Brother Cadfael books, which are medieval. Yes, yeah. Absolutely loved those. Shrewsbury. So, yeah, that's lovely. I like the 1920s as well. Tudor ones. I used to lap up all the stuff about the court, but I prefer reading about ordinary people. And there was quite a good series set in Germany, and I've forgotten what on earth it was called now, but the main character was the daughter of the executioner. And that was just quite an interesting way of looking at things, and that had to do with witchcraft, or at least the accusation of witchcraft. Then the Abir Mukherjee books, which are set in India in the 1920s, with a British man who's a police, I can't remember if he's an inspector, but anyway, quite senior, and his the Indian that works with him, they're very interesting because they look at the sort of like the end of the Raj and the tensions, the racial tensions and the political tensions going on.
Yeah, it's a really interesting premise, isn't it?
And they've got, the British guy who's gone through, you know, been affected by the Spanish flu, and the Indian guy. And then there's a young woman who's, you know, we'd probably call Eurasian now, but at the time she was, you know, she's half Indian, half what they would have called an Anglo-Indian.
They'd call Anglo-Indian.
Yeah, but she's half Indian and half white. So she's caught in that halfway place that they, socially speaking. Yes.
It's one of the things I've kind of wanted to look at in the Maisie books. And I was kind of hoping to have more Indian characters in them, but part of the problem was, to be historically accurate, the British just wouldn't have socialised.
They didn't, no. Did they? Just,
no, absolutely yeah.
Not at that so. Class level. No. A lower level, if you were sort of a missionary class, you might, but everybody else, no. Especially the women. Absolutely, especially yes. The women.
Well, they're Purdy, yes. Mm.
So I can see where you're coming from, though, because I've read all those, and they don't, do they? They don't mix with the people from that country. It's very little. Yes, of the mixing.
It does feel very, very strange, and I felt kind of
bad about reproducing it. I did put a note in at the end to say, no.
But that was
unfortunately how it was, yeah. So that's why there aren't that many, Indian characters in this book. So yes. But yeah, I mean, even in the 1890s, there were people, wanting independence and fighting for it. I think English people as well, not just Indian people. So yes. Yeah, so it was a very interesting time, and that's something you don't always see.
And very interesting and also very dangerous, I should imagine, depending on who you were and where you lived.
Yes.
A lot of people came back, didn't they, because they were... There was uprisings and all sorts of things.
Well, there was the Indian Mutiny, yes.
Yeah, in that character, the 1920s Abhimanyu, the Indian character, he's a policeman, and he's under a lot of pressure from his family, who feel like it's sort of a traitor. He's torn because he wants independence, but he's got a job to do. And there's a lot of that the tensions, the terrorism that was going on, the uprisings and so on. So, where do your loyalties lie? It's very interesting. As well as being good, good mysteries. It's just a good characters because they've all three of them got their little, they've been pulled in two different directions
Which way do you step?
Yes, and I must admit, when I'm watching, I do really like, series where you have all the hansom cabs on the top.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and the flowing dresses, yes. Running down a staircase and not falling flat on your faces, which is what would happen to me. But
I'm not sure how historically accurate that is. I bet a lot of people fell down staircases.
Yes,
but they probably had servants to do it for them.
I wonder where history. It seems like a silly thing to say, but I wonder where history begins and ends. Because I'm thinking now, something that Liz said earlier on about, or somebody said earlier about, writing stories today where we're surrounded by technology. When I was a child, when I were a lad, starting school, I mean, going back to the sort of 1950s, life was very, very different in terms of communication, technology, and yet you don't hear of many stories being set in the 50s and 60s. I think there will be soon, that will be history, but at what point does an age become...
Well, when I did my GCSE history, one of the things we studied was Tiananmen Square.
All right, yes.
And I did my GCSE in 1990, so... that was pretty recent.
It was interesting because I did history O-level, and which goes ages me. But anyway, I did history O-level, and that was Europe 1870 to 1945, fascinating period. When my children did history, they were studying Cold War, which, of course, I was living through as a teenager. But then somebody the other day said, on the other hand, on the 12th of September 2001, 9/11 would have been history already, because it was just such a big cataclysmic event that you'd have known that's history. It only happened yesterday, but it's still history.
Yeah.
There's one book called it's called The Fenian. I've forgotten who it's written by. Mike Kernan, is that Mike Kernan?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and that's set in Glasgow in the 1970s, and that 1970s is historical, and the characters in it are older than I would have been, but there are bits, and I didn't live anywhere near Glasgow, but there are things that you'd be, I remember that, but it was a long time ago, really.
I have 30 years in my mind as when history sort of starts, so the 80s are history. Yeah. I remember a shocking
That's ridiculous. History, the 1980s are only 15 years ago, so that's not true.
I know this is true, but also scary thing is that the Human League's, I think, first album is closer to the end of World War II than it is to today.
When I watch Call the Midwife, the original series, they'd be using equipment that I'd used. you know, and there was and I was like, oh, I've used one of those balsam inhalers. I've used what I've used those poultices, you know. So yeah, it makes you feel old. So we're going to draw this to a close now. And again, I'd like to thank Paula for joining us. It's been a really interesting conversation. And for all the other times you've popped on Zoom and joined us, it's like you've been in the room with us, Paula.
I'm next door secretly.
Yeah.
Can I just say, Liz, that when I put some episodes up after this on the blog, I'll put some links to Paula's books.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, we can do that. So yeah, I'll draw it to a conclusion and thank everybody for their work today and our lively. We always have a lively discussion, and join us next time. We're here every Thursday at 5 p.m. So we'll see you then. Bye now.
Bye.
You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.